So, our last subject before, I'm aware that I'm the only thing that separates you from lunch. So, in order not to draw your ire on me, I'll try to be brief. Let me just start with a little observation on the empirical record, since we're talking about the performance of financial intermediaries before. So, the empirical fact is that of all the investment funds quoted at the New York Stock Exchange, if you take the average, they performed worse than the average of the Dow Jones. Okay, so if you invest your money with an investment fund, in average you get a lower performance than if you just invest your money yourself there, and if you so do without the sophisticated techniques that they bring along. We have a similar surprising result when we turn to deflation. It is one of the most firmly held convictions among economists, and monetary economists in particular, that deflation is very bad and needs to be prevented at virtually any cost. It's the basic rationale, one of the basic rationales underlying Keynesian macroeconomics, and it's one of the basic rationales underlying prevailing monetary institutions, particular the president of a central bank and of paper money, the purpose of which is to fight deflations, prevent precise situations in which we have either a strongly falling price level and or a strongly declining money supply, which has the consequence of a price level that is lower than it would otherwise have been. Now, if we there's been a very interesting study published last year by two Berkeley economists, or at least one of them was a Berkeley economist. It's been published with the NBER in the United States, which proves again that occasionally mainstream economists can do useful work. It's not really economic theory, but at least bring about results that are helpful or interesting. And so what they found out in examining historical episodes of deflation was that they are not systematically correlated with depression. Okay. So the empirical record shows us that there's something fishy about the official story, which is that deflation, in any case, is the economic nightmare, is the economic scapegoat that justifies not only monetary policy, but also our present monetary institutions, in particular central banks and paper money. So we need to take a closer look then at the theory of deflation. And if we turn to the Austrian theory of money, we find indeed good reasons to believe that there is no systematic link between depressions and deflation. The deflations are far less dangerous economically than they appear in the light of the Keynesian hystericalist scenario. And that, in fact, their true significance, the true political significance, is a different one than the one that is commonly communicated. Now, deflation has been, despite its role as a scapegoat, has been a subject notoriously under-researched by economists. So it's only in the past 2 years or so that economists have turned again their attention to the theory and to the history of deflation. It has been, it seemed to be a subject that was just part of the bad old days before the Keynesian Revolution for a very long time. And only after the stock market crash of 2001, more and more economists came to believe that despite all institutional safeguards that we have created, again, paper money in particular and central banks, there might be a danger of deflation looming around the corner. So from the Austrian side, We have organized a symposium on deflation, and the proceedings have been published in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, volume 6, number 4, 2003. So for those of you who want to look this up, and this is good stuff. Now we, as Austrians, had the great advantage of being able to base our more recent research on the works of Mises and Rothbard. And if it's true that Austrian economics is superior to all other schools of economic thought in general, this holds true in particular when it comes to money. In no other field is the Austrian theory not only so much better, but also leads to radically different conclusions, practical conclusions, than mainstream approaches than in the field of money. So reason enough for us to have a closer look here. And I will start by recalling to your minds what Professor Hoppe had said yesterday in his lecture on money, or then in the lecture on banking, that one of the main propositions of monetary theory, at any rate from the Austrian point of view, is that the quantity of money in itself ultimately does not matter. Okay, that's the fundamental proposition. Whatever the money supply is, any money supply can satisfy the exchange services, or can render the exchange services that any size economy might need. And the reason is that money, the services that we derive from the money supply vary according with its purchasing power. Okay, so that's and the purchasing power itself is not a physical characteristic of the object that serves as money. Right? If I have wonderful monetary object like this one, right? So for this one, I can buy a decent bottle of wine in France right now. Does not mean that somehow physically the ability to buy a bottle of Chinon 2001, of my favorite brands, with this paper ticket, is somehow physically linked up with it. Rather, this can change, right? Prices can change, and so I might be able to buy more or less of this in the future. And this was, in fact, one of the reasons, one of the ideas, the central ideas of the classical economists, to stress this fact, and here in particular Jean-Baptiste Say, who came up with the following thought experiment that is still useful today and is still widely used, in which we consider two different economies, let's say one economy A and one economy B, and we have exactly the same real structure in both cases. We have the same economy, and let's say so there's one tomato, and there's one chair, and there's one car, and one fridge on the market. And so in economy A, we have certain prices that are a function of the money supply, which we might assume to be 1,000. And 1,000 can be anything, 1,000 ounces of silver, let's say. And so the tomato price would be, let's say, 0.5, the chair price would be 10, the car price would be 200, and the fridge price would be 50. Okay. Now we assume, if we contrast to this case, an economy B that is exactly equal but only has a different money supply, let's say double of the money supply, then we could argue, okay, the money prices will be exactly double. There are reasons to believe that it will not be exactly double, but we don't have to care about this now. Right? So the point of the whole exercise is just to illustrate that the quantity of money, changing the quantity of money will change the money price. It does not directly affect the supplies of real goods and services. And of course, we can also imagine an economy C, where the money supply will only be half, and then accordingly adjust our prices in this way. Now, let's look at these facts from two points of view, one from the point of view of the consumer and then from the point of view of the producer. From the point of view of a consumer, it is clear that in the economy B, which has a higher money supply, his revenue will be higher than in the economy A. Right, he will nominally have a higher revenue. But on the other hand, he has to pay higher prices for consumer goods as well. So his real position, his real revenue, will be exactly equal than in economy A. And inversely, in the economy C, he would have a lower revenue, but he would also have to pay lower prices for consumer goods. So therefore, again, it can be indifferent as to the position. Now let's take the point of view of the entrepreneur. What counts for the entrepreneur is not the absolute level of prices per se, but as Professor Hoppe has observed yesterday, price spreads. That is, the entrepreneur does not care about, well, let's say he is a chair producer, he does not care about the price for chairs. He cares about the relation between the price of chairs and the prices he has to pay for the factors of production needed to produce chairs. Okay? Now, in the economy where the money supply is double, in economy B, is the money supply is double than economy A, he obtains higher prices for chairs, but he also has to pay higher prices for factors of production. So there's no a priori reason to assume that he will make higher profits or lower profits. Right? And the economy C, the same thing. The prices that he obtains for his product are lower, but the prices that he has to pay for all factors of production are lower as well. So again, his revenue or the profit that he derives will not a priori differ from the profits that he would derive in any of the other economies. Now, this, ladies and gentlemen, is the reason why the classical economist paid attention in their analysis of the economy only to real factor. They completely neglected the monetary side, right? Because the simple illustration, right, was sufficient to demonstrate for them that money has no impact on the real economy. In particular, they arrived at the crucially correct insight that by increasing the quantity of money, right, we cannot improve our overall economic situation. That is, we cannot improve the economic situation of the aggregate. Okay? So here we have the first axiom of monetary economics. The quantity of money per se, or variations of the quantity of money, do not improve nor deteriorate the economic performance of the aggregate. This performance is ultimately determined by real factors. And at the same point, we have here also the central point of disagreement with all the Keynesians, because the fundamental premise of Keynesian economics is that by modifying the quantity of money, you can improve the economic performance of the aggregate. Right? That is why Keynes stressed in his general theory of employment, interest, and money, right, that it was demarcating his venture from those of the classical economists. Say, well, they were just reasoning in a static framework. I'm interested in the performance and the dynamics. Right? So the question whether we can, by economic policy and here monetary policy in particular, improve the outcome of the aggregate. Okay, so that's the central point. So therefore, all the whole debate around this is of central practical importance. Now, the second axiom, two fundamental axioms of monetary economics. The first one I just enunciated. The second one has been also mentioned by Professor Hoppe, and that is the axiom that variations in the quantity of money have a differential impact on the members of society. Okay, so even though I do not improve or deteriorate the overall performance of the economic system by variations in the quantity of money, I do, by necessity, have a redistribution effect. Right? As the relative economic position of different members of society will be affected by these variations of the money supply, because the new money supply arrives first in the hands of certain market participants, and from there on spreads onto the rest of the economy. These effects, or redistribution effects, are commonly called Cantillon effects, after Richard Cantillon, who in the early 18th century wrote a book with the title The Nature of Commerce in General, in which he placed great stress on these effects. Now, Cantillon's message has never been completely forgotten, but the classical economists thought they could ignore this, or thought in any case that it was not very important. It was only Ludwig von Mises who brought these effects again to the fore, and stressed in particular that the Cantillon effects are the root cause of intertemporal misallocation, right, of resources, about which we've talked this morning. And then are also of crucial political significance, right? Because we have a source of conflict between members of society. Who should be the recipient first? As soon as we have a central bank, it is clear that whatever the policy of the central bank is, whatever investment projects it subsidizes with new issues of money, new credits, and so on, it is exercising a discriminatory decision in favor of some members of society to the detriment of other members of society. And Mises himself stressed that this was a fundamental problem of all monetary unions based on paper money, because it was to be accepted that there would be a constant redistribution struggle between the different nations or the different groups organized within the monetary union. And in fact, that is something that's a crucial a flaw of the present European monetary system, of the European Central Bank and the euro, that in fact the ECB has the arbitrary power to favor certain groups at the expense of all other citizens. So it has this power, and so necessarily its policies will be substance matter for endless strife. It's something that is not discussed by monetary economists because they love, of course, central banks and paper money, right, as instruments of the application of their own theories. Okay, so after these general remarks, let me just go through the main cases that exist for deflation and then show by case for case analysis that why there are good reasons to believe that we don't have to worry overly much about deflation for economic reasons. We can start by first considering deflation in the sense of a decrease of the price level brought about from the real side, that is from the good side, right? And then turn to considering the monetary side, the demand for money first and then the supply of money. So we have causes of deflation. Now, deflation understood in the today conventional sense, decrease in the price level, there are good reasons to use the word deflation in a more narrow sense, meaning a decrease in the money supply, but we don't have to worry about these definitional things, right? Uses of words and so on, that's not very important. So we have here the first cause is growth. Growth at a constant money supply. Then we have a second cause that is hoarding. A third cause is a decrease of the money supply, so of MS, as we say. And and then we have also a fourth cause that is interventionism, monetary interventionism. So here, the third cause would be a decrease of the money supply brought about by by a conscious decision of the money producer. The fourth cause would be a more or less involuntary consequence of previous government intervention. Okay, we start with the first cause, so we have economic growth. And this allows us to deal with the most widely held misconception about deflation, namely that a growing economy requires a growing money supply to operate smoothly, right? So the idea is, it's kind of a correspondence idea, correspondence theory, right? You have here a blob that is the volume of trade, okay? And this must correspond to the money supply. If this grows, then this must grow too, unless it will be impossible to sell all these goods and services here. Okay, but that is, ladies and gentlemen, that's nonsense, right? Because it is very well possible to sell all goods and services, as we have said before, by simply decreasing the money prices at which these goods and services are sold. So if the quantity of goods and services goes up due to economic growth, these will be sold at ever lower prices, thus permitting to buy and sell them all with the existing money supply. I mean, all that happens is that prices decrease. Now, the crucial question is, of course, how can this be? Doesn't this put, how is this possible for entrepreneurs to do this? How can they operate profitably if they have to pay prices for factors of production now and only in the future, when the greater supplies of goods and services come to the market, prices will go down? How can they operate profitably? And the simple answer can be summed up with the word anticipation, anticipation. Right? So one of the essential tasks of entrepreneurship, or we can say the central task of entrepreneurship, is to anticipate future prices. If entrepreneurs anticipate that prices will go down in the future, well, then they can pay only lower prices for factors of production now. Okay? And the next step, next problem that appears is, well, what if the factor owners do not agree? And if they say, well, I will not sell whatever, my labor, or I will not rent out my land to you at this lower price. I don't agree with your anticipation. Well, the answer to this question is, well, there's nothing wrong with this. If they don't go down with their price, well, it means that they have a better employment for their property than on the terms offered by our entrepreneur. Right? So we can say, okay, we have an entrepreneur here and we represent his investment project with a time X. He will sell here and now he's buying factors of production. And if he does not, if he is unable to buy the factors of production that he needs to complete his project at lower prices here in the present, well, it means that the factor owners, let's say a worker, right, has a better alternative. For example, he can just stay at home. Right? He refuses to work. He has savings and so on. He will not work for this lower wage rate, or he will work for another entrepreneur that offers him higher wage rates, right? So the only reason why people would be unwilling to trade with him at the lower prices that he proposes is that they have better alternatives. And there's nothing wrong with this, right? And that is so in any business environment, right? Whether it's inflation or deflation, what else, monetary stability, whatever. Okay, so there's nothing wrong with it. What is clear, however, is if this anticipation is correct, if prices will indeed go down in the future, well, then sooner or later the factor owners, for example, the workers, will be unable to find anybody offering them better terms. Okay, so sooner or later then they will be forced to accept the terms offered by our entrepreneurs who offer only lower recompensation in anticipation of the future lower prices. Okay, so there's no reason to anticipate any problems for a growing economy within a deflationary context. There's nothing inherently impossible to arrange ever lower prices for factors of production in a deflationary economy. Now, as far as the labor market is concerned in particular, there the deflationary impact will be lowest. Why is that? Well, because labor is the most universally usable factor of production, so it can be used to in production processes that are very close to completion. So in the first order production processes, companies that produce consumer goods, and also companies that produce producers' goods. And well, if we would have to say, in anticipation of a lower price in the future, this will have an all the more low, greater impact on factors of production used way back here in the production chain. Okay, so if we anticipate a price decrease here at the end of the production, this will have an ever greater impact on the prices paid for factors of production there, because we have to discount the prices by the interest rate. Okay, so we'll have a greater impact here. And so deflation will impact especially raw materials and so on, but not so much labor, because the laborer is constantly the alternative of working here or here. Right? So there's constant arbitrage processes going on. The same alternative does not exist for raw materials, let's say iron ore or something, which can be used only here. So these raw materials, their price will decrease very strongly in a deflationary environment, whereas the price of labor, which is universally usable, will not decrease that much. That is the reason also why real wage rates will increase, right? All other prices will decrease much stronger than the nominal wage rates. So we have a constant increase of real wages, which is exactly what economic growth is all about. Now that's my main story already, and therefore I will only illustrate that the same reasoning holds true also for all other cases. Most importantly, the case of hoarding. What is hoarding? Hoarding is an increase of the demand for money. Right? It's a pejorative expression for saying that the demand of money goes up. What is the demand of money? The demand of money is our evaluation of a money, quantity of money relative to other goods. Right? So if I have a higher demand for money, this means that I'm ready to work more or to sell more of my other property to get a given unit of money. And inversely, I'm only ready to pay lower prices for a given unit of money that I bought before. An example. Let's say before my demand of money went up, I bought one tomato for 0.5 ounces of silver, and I worked 1 hour for, let's say, 2 ounces of silver. Okay. Now, if my demand for money goes up, what does this mean? Well, it means that I'm ready to buy a tomato only if I get it at a lower price. Right? So, for example, if I pay this price. On the other hand, I'm ready, in order to obtain the same amount of money, and now I would be ready to work longer. Right? So, for example, I would be ready to buy to work 1.5 hours. To get 2 ounces of silver. What does this mean? It shows that the purchasing power of money, by the very fact that my demand for money increases, goes up, right? Because now I can buy tomato at tomato can be bought on the market for 0.4 ounces of silver, and 2 ounces of silver can buy 1.5 hours of work, whereas before they could buy only two. Right? That is, here again we see that the services rendered by money are self-adjusting to variations in the demand for money. There's no reason to accommodate a change in the demand for money by changes in the money supply. Right? What is just simply changing is the purchasing power of money. We do not have to accommodate the changes in the demand for money with changes in the money supply. We can just leave the money supply what it is. Okay. And very similar considerations also apply if the money supply decreases. Right? There's no reason to believe that entrepreneurs cannot anticipate a decrease in the money supply if this should ever happen. Empirically, it's a very rare circumstance. Okay, but there's no reason to anticipate or to believe that entrepreneurs should be unable to do this. And they would adjust to such an expectation in exactly the same way as they adjust to secular growth and to increased hoarding. Right? They would simply cut down prices for factors of production, and this could occur quite simply as any other change. I won't talk about the fourth reason, interventionism, because we are here mainly concerned about the technical argument. So what does this leave us with? It leaves us with the notion that deflation per se is not economically more harmful than any other change occurring in the economy. It does not put the entrepreneurs before fundamentally different or more serious problems than any other major change occurring in the economy. Right? And especially if deflation is constant and secular and so on, it's very easy to adjust to it, just to any other business environment. So what is then the main significance of deflation if it is not economic? Well, the main significance is that it jeopardizes, or it can jeopardize, the economic position of those entities, whether business entities or governments, that rely in their operations on a high debt ratio. An entrepreneur that is heavily indebted is confronted through deflation to the problem that at the lower price level that comes into being through deflation, he will be unable to to pay back his debt. Let's say I have a situation A, which the price level is 100 in my index, and in a situation B, the price level is 50. If I contracted debt in the situation A, and now we get through deflation to a situation B, well, very probably I will be unable to pay back my debt. Okay, so deflation is more often than not, I mean, there are exceptional scenarios that we can imagine, but more often than not, the death sentence for all entities that are financed primarily through debt and not through equity. Deflation is no problem for entrepreneurs financing their operations through equity. Okay, but it's a problem for all those operating on debt. Now, if you think of it, well, who are these entities operating mainly on debt? Well, particularly, we have to think here of governments, right? And we have to think of the business units that are by and large financed through fractional reserve banks, through bank credit. Right? So this opens up then a completely new perspective on the now political significance of deflation. Right? Namely that deflation is in fact, from a libertarian point of view at any rate, a very desirable outcome because it cuts off the roots under those undesirable elements of society that shouldn't be in the positions of power that they presently have. Right? It's the way the market clears the bad plans, right? Drives them out, and makes free the way for new entrepreneurs, for a new establishment. Right? One effect of inflation, that's a political effect of inflation, is in fact to preserve the existing structure of owners within a society. Right? Inflation is the most important means by which the present economic and thus political establishment stays in power. And if you read very carefully Keynes, you'll find that that was in fact one of the driving motivations, one of the main ideas that inspired him to campaign against deflation. Right? Keynes saw very clearly that inflation has this revolutionary impact on society too. He didn't like inflation for this reason. But he saw that deflation has exactly the same impact. Right? It brings about a change in the structure of ownership. There will be a new economic elite, a new establishment that comes into play. Right? So deflation and inflation are then forces by which we have something like a circulation of elites. Circulation of elites. This is an expression has been coined by Vilfredo Pareto, neoclassical economist, a mathematical economist, ladies and gentlemen, but he had a great insight. Right? So there is in a market economy, in a free economy, you have a constant circulation of elites. Right? Those people with the best ideas, the greatest profits, drive out people with inferior ideas or products that are considered by the consumers not as being as important as their products and so on. What inflation does is to keep the existing establishment artificially, for an artificially long time, in its present position. And Keynes, convinced as he was that he and his friends were indispensable for the well-functioning of British society, became a great advocate of the fight for monetary stabilization. And that was what prompted him to say, well, we need to get rid of both deflation and inflation, because both are forces that somehow bring disorder into society. The wrong guys get to the top, right? But we need us. So again, right, so the significance of deflation is not economic. We don't have to worry about deflation making it impossible for an economy to function well. But it has a great political significance in that it is, so to say, the last resort for a free society where the political institutions don't function anymore, right? Where the political institutions don't assure the circulation of elites, and where for institutions such as paper money and central banks, we have no more adequate circulation of elites within the economic sector. There, deflation comes into play with a big cut and clears the field. Now, it's 1 o'clock, I've achieved my goal, communicate the essential ideas. And, well, actually, it's 12:59, so we have 1 minute for a question. There's a question here.
Hello. If inflation causes increasing nominal interest rates, you should expect that deflation causes, or perhaps could cause nominal negative interest rates. If that is the case, how can you then make anyone safe at all in banks, since you can gain more purchasing power from having your money outside?
Yeah. Well, inflation, deflation can never create a negative interest rate, precisely because nobody would lend us money at these terms. So even in the case of deflation, you would observe some nominally positive interest rate, be it ever so small. Right? Otherwise, no deal would be struck. It's very simple. Right? But okay, then again, empirically, we have to say, well, so what? I say, a decrease in the money supply is a very unlikely event. An increase of economic growth, which would just lead to a secular decline of the price level, that is much more likely, but doesn't pose a great problem for interest rates. Right? They would be somewhat lower, might be between 1 or 2%, but would still subsist. Strong deflations come at very short notice, are very important, usually happen after periods of inflation of the money supply through banks, fractional reserve banks in particular. But these are rather short periods. So typically we're talking here about periods of 8 months to about 2 years. Right, so that's, if we look at the historical record, that's about the period that we're talking about. And during this period, it might indeed often be impossible that any credit is given on at interest and so on. But again, so it only reinforces the position of people operating with equity rather than with debt. So there's no problem there, whatever, right? So from an economic point of view, there's no reason a priori to favor debt finance business rather than equity finance business, right? We have no means to say, well, that is better than the other one. We'll leave it here. Thank you very much. Good. Bon appétit.